Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
Years did such a wonderful work. I believe that's the largest congregation in Kentucky. And so a lot of really good work that's being done there by that congregation. And if you remember, in our future ministers camp, Jason Hart comes and helps with that every year, and he is now preaching there and working alongside Brother Dale. As Brother Dale does outreach ministries. He has studied at Fried Hardeman, Oklahoma Christian, Murray State, and also Vanderbilt University. And in addition to that, has done work with Fried Hardeman on the Board of Trustees, also a member of the local hospice board. And I've thought this week about the appropriateness of tonight's topic, dealing with tragedy, as all of us as a nation have watched the tragedy that took place last week. And if you have listened to the news or you've read individuals' comments, at times like this, people are searching for how to cope with tragic events. And as we deal with some of these issues tonight, it's going to be a blessing for Brother Dale to guide us through that. A few years ago, we had Brother Dale come to Mount Juliet Church of Christ, where I was working at the time, and dealing with some similar issues in his lesson. And I've never forgotten that lesson. In fact, I have referred people to that in some discussions, to the audio version of that that's on the website. And that has truly been a blessing to me over the years. And so I know tonight is going to be a blessing for us as well. Without taking up any more of his time, we'll have Brother Dale come and teach us.
Thank you very much. Does everyone have a copy? There are a few. Here are a few right here, sir. Does everyone else have one? There's still some extras. I made 300. I was optimistic. I'm delighted to get to come back to Columbia. I had a funeral this afternoon in Paris, Tennessee, at 2 o'clock, and I was beginning to wonder if I was going to make it, actually. Fortunately, the burial was in Camden, so it was on the way, and I made it without any problems at all. And I am thankful, very thankful to be here. The subject of coping with tragedy, dealing with tragedy, is one that isn't fun to talk about, but it's one that doesn't go away. And it's one for which we need to be ready at any time, because anything can happen with no notice whatsoever. Imagine your family and you going to a movie, and all of a sudden everything breaks loose. One of the security people at Murray State and I had a conversation the other day about it, and I know Mike Green, different ones have dealt with this and still have to deal with it. But there is nothing more vulnerable than a public gathering such as a theater or a school setting or a church setting for things like that. We have almost no protection and no way to have protection. We take common sense guards and guidelines, but it can still happen and happen so quickly. So the thing to do is to realize, without becoming negative and without being pessimistic or paranoid people, to realize that there will be tragedy. Now, what you call a tragedy might not be a tragedy to someone else, because any setback is regarded as a tragedy sometimes, just any setback. Several years ago, in fact, it was soon after my wife and I married, which was 43 years ago, we had bought a car, just like most young couples who don't have any money but who do want a car. So we went and bought a car. I drove it from the dealership on 12th Street in Murray across the street to Jerry's restaurant because we were going to eat. And in the parking lot at the restaurant, having owned that car for all of 30 seconds, someone opened the door viciously and made a crease right down the door. I thought that was a tragedy. But most people wouldn't think that's a real tragedy at all. First new car I'd ever owned or even thought about owning. And it really, I didn't know what to do. I mean, I was the preacher out in the county there, and I knew I wasn't supposed to go wild and be in a rage. I knew I wasn't supposed to curse. I knew I wasn't supposed to do a lot of things. So my wife said she thought I was going to bend the steering wheel around the columns because I thought I could do that at that moment. But what do you do when you're faced with a real tragedy? I still don't like nicks on my car, but I've lived long enough to know that that doesn't qualify as a real tragedy. Real tragedies involve things like, and if you want to look on the definitions that I've given on the back, right in the middle at number 3 on points to ponder, that the tragedy is a shocking event, a sad event, or a disaster. So if we understand that any shocking event can be defined as a tragedy, any disaster, it may be weather-related, it may be death-related, it may have lots of different facets to it, but it qualifies as a disaster and deals as a tragedy in the perception of the person who's having to deal with it. And so whatever your tragedies may be, or whatever tragedies you see others going through, there are some general guidelines that we can use to help us deal with our own and to help others as they deal with theirs. Death is the one thing that is so obvious that can't go away for now, and we keep dealing with it. I had 70 funerals last year, and 59 of them were in the same funeral home. The boys who run the funeral home there, and I say boys, I say that respectfully, they're 43 and 37. I think they're boys because I remember when both of them were born. But they've bought the funeral home, and I'm now renting an office from them in the lower floor of that with faces another street. And I have threatened them if they don't treat me nice as a landlord, I will revoke their baptismal certificates and their marriage licenses, both of them. But they're really good guys. They're dear friends. We spend a lot of time together anyway. But one of them told me, he says, "You're talking about retiring. I know you keep talking about retiring." He said, "We have $7 million worth of prearrangements here, and your name is on half of them." So he said, "You're not retiring, really." I don't think he literally meant that, but I know that there are going to be deaths. I know that. Hebrews 9:27 says that, but we would know it even without that. It is appointed a man once to die, and after this the judgment. So the fact that death came as a consequence of sin, and death is still here, but will eventually be conquered, and there will be no more death, Revelation 21:4. And that isn't in the here and now, though. That's later. So dealing with it is either going to be done poorly or done well. It's going to be up to us as to how we deal with it. I'd like to offer these guidelines, these considerations, not from a biblical perspective over on the front of your page, the tasks of mourning, the manifestations of normal grief, the facilitating uncomplicated grief, and some things to avoid saying at the time of a death. These are not absolutes, but they probably are good suggestions for us. It's never good at the time of a tragedy, even if you don't consider it a tragedy, to dump it into a vat and call it God's will. It doesn't usually help. Again, I am not a hyper-Calvinist. I do not believe that God, before the foundation of the world, picked my name to be lost or picked my name to be saved, and that I will simply fall into that prearranged mold. I do not believe that. I believe He gives me the power of choice, And that if he chooses to know my future, that's fine. But if he doesn't choose to exercise that as one of his powers, that's fine too. I know he has powers he isn't using. He's not raising the dead today, but he could. He did. He doesn't choose to exercise all of his powers. But to dump it into a vat and call it the will of God simply takes all of the responsibility away from us and dumps all of it on him. That's not fair. Adam and Eve sinned in the Garden of Eden. And through their sin, we have many consequences that we live with today. If we do not accept responsibility for our own attitudes, actions, and words, we continually blame God for all of it. And that is not fair. When I was 12 years old, my 10-year-old cousin got killed in a fireworks accident. He held a Roman candle up to his abdomen. He reached around and lit it, and it backfired for some reason. And the stick that was supposed to be in the ground went into his abdomen and perforated the lining of the intestine, and he developed peritonitis, and he died in 4 days. This was on Christmas Day that the accident happened, and he died then on the 29th. People came to the funeral home in Paris in large numbers, and many of them said, "It's God's will. It's God's will." Well, I'm all of 12 at that time. 1 year earlier, my mother had died. And people came to the same funeral home and said, "It's God's will." That's 2 years in a row that significant people in my life came to say, "It's God's will." And by the time I was 13, I was so scared of him that I didn't know what to do. I didn't know if I was next on his list. And I didn't know how to process the poor information that I was getting. At 14, ripe old age of 14, freshman in high school, I fell apart. Basically disintegrated. And one little piece at a time, I got put back together. My dad was a wonderful man. He was not a psychiatrist nor a psychologist, but he was a committed Christian gentleman who was determined to raise his 3 boys the best he could with the help of the Lord. And so he got me some good help, some good professional help, and some wonderful help through delightful brethren at Eastwood Church of Christ in Paris, Tennessee. And I am forever indebted to that wonderful church for my childhood experience. But in the process, the thing that I had to remember and learn and deal with was that God is not at fault when trouble comes. But God will work in our troubles to His glory. So just dumping it in a vat and calling it the will of God is not enough. And it is also at times not even accurate. In the second place, we do not want to say, "I know just how you feel." Probably, I don't know just how you feel. If I haven't walked in your moccasins, I don't really know. I may have an idea. I may have been in similar circumstances, but it probably doesn't help you for me to say, "I know just how you feel." In the third place, it's probably not best to say you're not the only one who hurts. In other words, why are you so upset? Don't you know a lot of people are in pain? Don't you know a lot of people who've had tragedies? That doesn't help. It's called non-facilitative communication in time of grief. Non-facilitative means just don't say it. It doesn't help. In the next place, it's not always good to say it could be a lot worse. Well, of course it could be a lot worse. Instead of 12 people killed in a theater, there could have been 24. It could be a lot worse. Instead of 3,000 killed in September 11, 2001, it could have been 6,000. That's true. But it doesn't help to say it could be a lot worse. This one is one that I really, really, really could not imagine someone saying. Several years ago, our high school seniors, we had 32 of them. And of course, again, I've been there so long that I was there when they were born. I was with them through a lot, and I was close friends with them and with their families, many of them at least. And one of the young men, who was probably the leader of the group, who was the most prominent one in the group — there are no unimportant people, but still he was regarded as a leader among his peers, and a fine young man in every way — he came to our house on Sunday night. I was grilling hamburgers after church, and the seniors all came and ate the hamburgers, and my wife fixed all the stuff other than that, and they all bragged on how good the food was. And they were so courteous and kind. And this young man, who was about 6'6", picked up my wife and just walked around with her and told her how good the cookies and stuff were and all that stuff, and gave me a big hug and thanked me for the delicious hamburgers and just how nice we were and all that. He got in his car and drove off, and the next morning he was killed in a bicycle accident. Just a terrible, terrible thing. And one of our other teenage girls was driving the car that hit him. And so it was just a double tragedy for the church there and for some very dear people. Well, at the funeral home then, on Tuesday night, the visitation, and on Wednesday, the funeral, at the church building. Building completely full, building seats 1,500, and it was full. But at that Tuesday night visitation at the church, at the funeral home, the lines were long, and one lady came up to the mom at the casket and said, "Well, at least you have other children." And she said — I love this — she said, "Yes, I do, and I am so thankful, but I didn't have one to spare." I like that. And I thought about it a lot after that. God doesn't have any children to spare either, and He has lots of children. And each of them is loved personally. And it's a wonderful thing to know that you're loved. And that when a tragedy comes, it's important, because there are no unimportant people. And so it isn't best to say you do have other children. And then there's something that was said at my mother's death. So many people came to our house. I had just turned 11, and I didn't know what was going on. I didn't understand much of anything. But I knew the house was full of people. Just people from everywhere. People I didn't know. Some I did. But everybody who started to leave said to my dad, "If there's anything I can do, let me know." And I'm thinking, "Mow the yard." But I didn't say it. I just thought it. The dishes were stacked up in the kitchen above the windowsill. And I wanted to say, "Wash the dish." I couldn't understand why they came to eat anyway. There are restaurants in town, but they came to our house to eat. I couldn't figure it out. But I didn't say anything. I just pondered it. But I decided, after I processed all those things a few years later and tried to figure out what to say or not say, I'm not ever going to say that. In my whole life, I'm not ever going to say that. I know people mean well. I don't want to harshly judge anybody. But the very idea of saying, "If there's anything I can do, let me know," when it's obvious something needs doing, do it. Just go ahead and do it. And then the last thing. About 7, 8 years ago, one of our young men, 20 years old, gotten into West Point. He was just doing so well. Everybody was so proud of him. He was in pilot training, and we do not know what happened, but his plane was drilled into the ground and he was killed instantly. And so, the funeral again, the same church building, full again. A family so grieved. And a couple of years after his funeral, his mother, who's very active in many community things and who is just a delightful person and a cousin to my wife, had commented to another lady something about her son. She commented about Roger and about something that was tender. And the lady said to her, "Are you still grieving over that? It's been a year, or it's been 2 years." And here's what Donna said. And I asked her if I could use her name, and I asked her if I could repeat what she said. And she said, yes, anywhere you want to, it's okay. The lady said, are you still grieving over that? Donna said, yes, he's still dead. She said, if you'll bring him back, I won't grieve anymore. I like that. I like that. We don't need to say ridiculous things if we can keep from it. Keeping one foot out of the mouth is a real chore for some of us. When both feet are down our throats, it's so hard to walk. Now, what should we say? I don't know. I give up. I just don't know. But I don't know that it's important to say anything. Sometimes it's better to say less and just be present. I figured out years ago, I think one reason I have so many funerals is I'm very brief. I think people like brevity. But I don't say a lot. I don't think it's necessary to say a lot, when people are already so tired that they would just like for something respectful to be said and something that honors God and honors the deceased and move on. But someone asked Tom Holland in class one day when we were students at Freed Hardeman. We were all preacher boys, and he was telling us kind of under the table things that we might need to know. Good, really good to have that. And one of the guys spoke up in class and he said, Brother Holland, I'm looking forward to preaching. I really am. But he said, I don't want to do any funerals. And Tom Holland said, well, that will probably come with it. It just does. And so you need to be prepared and not let it throw you. He said, well, it just makes me nervous. And so we talked about it a little. And so finally he said, well, what I want to know is, what do you say to the family at the cemetery? He said, I've been to lots of funerals, and I know the preacher says something when he goes by and speaks. He said, what is it? Just tell me what that is, and maybe that'll help me. And Tom, if you know Tom, you know his wit and wisdom. He said, now listen real closely, and I'll tell you, and you'll always remember it. He said, are you listening? And the guy said, yes. He said, I'm listening. Tom said, mm-mm. He said, you think you can remember that? He said, what? He said, you don't have to say anything. Just be there. With sincerity, with genuine concern, you're there. Perhaps it's a hand on the shoulder. Perhaps it's a hand clasp. Perhaps it's a hug. It just says, I care. That's all there is to it. Don't make speeches. Don't outline things and present oratory. That's not the key. The key is your heart of compassion and concern. How do you deal with tragedies? Well, as you say something, try to say something that will help. And try to avoid saying things that don't help. And the rule of thumb is the less said, the better. Now, the sources that I use for all of these things are down at the bottom of your front page. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, Westberg, Warden, and so forth. Those are people who have written things that I have read. I have used them rather extensively. Now, if you would, on the back, on points to ponder, look with me briefly at the Bible study in John 11. We'll just glance at this. We won't get to study it. But Jesus deals with tragedy in the death of Lazarus, his dear friend. And in the process, Jesus regarded death as a sleep. He said, our friend Lazarus is asleep. Now, obviously, Lazarus had been sick, but he had died. Jesus meant death and sleep, meaning the same thing. The body goes to sleep. The spirit leaves the body. And so he regarded it as the figure, as the picture of sleep. Now, that's good for adults. It's not good for children, because they don't make the association and the figurative interpretation well. So if you have a six-year-old whose parent has died or grandparent has died, and you say, Mimi has gone to sleep. Well, Mimi never came back. And so he gets afraid to go to bed. doesn't want to go to sleep because he might not ever come back. He doesn't see the figure. Jesus is speaking to his apostles. They are adults. They're supposed to understand some figurative language. The body goes to sleep in that sense, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Ecclesiastes chapter 12. So, Jesus did not regard it as annihilation. The body goes to sleep in that sense. It is a wonderful time to have your faith deepened, but it could be a time to have your faith shaken. So anticipating what might come with tragedy and grief, we can be prepared without becoming paranoid or worrisome about those things. We don't want to be dwelling on something that way for too long. It's not healthy. But to be prepared for it, to walk through it in our minds as best we can, so that if and when the time comes that it really strikes us, it isn't brand new territory to us. So have your faith deepened rather than your faith shaken. And Jesus used all these passages here in John 11 to have faith deepened. There are many who will come to extend comfort by being with the bereaved. The Jews came, verse 19, to the home of Mary and Martha over at Bethany because of Lazarus' death. There are people who will come. Sometimes there will be more people than you know what to do with. There will be other times that just the ones who do come, and maybe they're few in number, but you will remember who came. You won't remember speeches and outlines, but you will remember who came. There will be times 15, 25 years later that someone will say to me or say to you, when this death happened in our family, I looked up at the funeral home and there you came in the door. And you will never know how much your coming through that door meant to me. And you didn't even have a clue it was a big deal at all. But it was a big deal because the person needed affirmation. The person needed an expression of sympathy and love and compassion. And your presence did it. People are going to come. If they say something, hopefully it'll be the right things. And on the other side of that, let's don't be too harsh in judging what people say. Most people mean well. And if somebody says, if there's anything I can do, let me know. I wouldn't say, oh, strike you dead. No. I would say, thank you. You could say, I know you mean well. I dare you to say, mow the yard or wash the dish. But that might be the very thing to do. Well, since you mentioned it, I would like for you to run an errand for me. I've got several things I have to do. And if you don't mind, it may teach the person to quit offering unless he or she really means it. Verse 20, the actions and reactions of the bereaved may take different form. You remember that Mary sat in the house. She was sitting there in the house. What did Martha do? She was up, ran out to meet Jesus. And it's fascinating that the wording of both women was the same, even though one got up to go meet Jesus before he got there, and the other sat still in the house and waited. What do we find? Lord, if you'd been here, our brother would not have died. We might change the wording of that to say, where were you when we needed you? And if that seems sarcastic, there's a chance that was the intention. It's hurt people who are saying things that would otherwise be offensive. But there's the sense in which your reaction is different from mine, and that's okay. We don't all do this the same way. Jesus wept tears. 23 to 27. Death is a good time to emphasize the resurrection. He said, your brother will rise again. Oh, I know he'll rise again in the resurrection. Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? And she said, I believe that you're the Christ, the Son of the living God, who should come into the world. It's a great time to have faith deepened and to emphasize the resurrection. Verses 33 to 38, Jesus wept tears, real tears of compassion and love. Why did Jesus weep? I know it's the shortest verse in the English Bible. Not in the Greek Bible, by the way. 1 Thessalonians 5:16 is shorter in the Greek New Testament. But in the English Bible, it is John 11:35. Jesus wept. All right? Why did he weep? He knew he was going to raise him from the dead. Was he weeping compassionate tears for Mary and Martha? Probably so. Was there any more to it than that? I think so. I think he's feeling sorry for Lazarus because he's going to bring him back. He's going to have to do it again. The poor guy had to go through it twice. No wonder Jesus wept. So we sing the song, "Does Jesus care when my heart is pained too deeply from earth and song? Does Jesus care when I've said goodbye to the dearest on earth to me?" And the chorus answers every time, "Oh yes, he cares. I know he cares. His heart is touched with my grief. When the days are weary, the long nights dreary, I know my Savior cares." He demonstrated that care and compassion at the tomb of Lazarus. Verse 39, Jesus told the people who were standing there to do what they could do and then turn it over to him, and he would do what they couldn't do. He said, "Take away the stone." Brother Fred Chun, whom some of you know, knew. Brother Fred Chun was my mother's preacher when she was growing up. At her death in 1957, Brother Chun spoke at the funeral service, and I only remember this one thing that he said. Verse 39, he said, is easy to overlook when you read the story of Lazarus. They came to the tomb, and Jesus said, "Take away the stone." And Brother Chun said, "Don't you know that anybody who could raise the dead could move a rock?" Why did he say that? He said, here's why he said that. They could do that. And he wanted them to do what they could do. And then to turn it over to him, and he would do what they couldn't do. They could move the rock. After all, they put it there. But they couldn't raise the dead. So he wants us to do what we can do. Casseroles? Lots of casseroles sometimes. Flowers? Memorial gifts? Contributions to the church or the church library or something? Those are all splendid things to do in memory and in honor of the deceased. The family is comforted by that. Jesus showed his compassion, and we can do what we can do, and then he can do more than we know how to ask or think. He saw it as an occasion to pray. It's always a good time to pray. Always. Again, Tom Holland, in our preacher in his work class, homiletics class, he said, if you don't know what to do, you're stuck, especially if you're in public. And something happens, he said, and I had this happen one Sunday. A gentleman came forward who was intoxicated, and it was a very difficult time for him and for me and for the family, and we didn't know what to do. The little books just don't tell you that. You can buy all the books on preaching, and they don't tell you what to do. But I remembered what Tom Holland said. You can always pray. So we had a prayer. And then we went on with things, and he and I were going to get together later and try to talk some more. One fellow told me as he was coming out, he said, "Why didn't you baptize that man?" I said, "Well, I might have drowned him if I'd tried that." I said, "That's not the thing to do right now." He said, "We didn't have this kind of stuff here till you came." I said, "Okay, I'll be gone someday." I stayed and stayed and stayed. I outlived my opposition. I hope you can do that. I hope everybody gets to do that. Just outlive your opposition if you can. But the point is, you're trying your best to do what's right, and it's always good to pray. It's always good. And then the last thing is verse 46. The people talk. Always they do. And when people say something positive and affirming about you or about the way you did something, it is to honor the Lord. And that's what we're all about anyway. To close, I want you to look at number 4, and I'll just mention this. As I began to process life and death and things as a child and then as an adult, There are two ways, two things to remember. Number one, if what happens to you is good, thank God, because He's the giver of every good and perfect gift. If what happens to you is not good, please don't call it good if it's not, but pray that God will work in it for good. And He promised that He would to those who love Him and are called according to His purpose. While that may not be deep theology, I don't know of a better way to operate than to praise God for everything that's good and to beg Him to work in everything else for good and to His glory. And as you and I encounter our own tragedies and as we help other people deal with theirs, I don't believe that that formula will ever be improved on at all. Would you bow with me for a moment of prayer, please? Father in heaven, thank You for blessing us and loving us and showing Your compassion and mercy to us in so many ways. Thank You for Jesus, who is not only our Savior and Lord, but also our Master Teacher and our perfect example. Bless us to learn from His teachings and from His example, and to learn every day to be more like Him. Help us to point people in His direction, to honor Him by the things that we say and do, and to meet our own challenges and tragedies in life in ways that will honor You the most. And bless us then to have compassion for others who meet their challenges and tragedies, that all of us, with patience with one another, and with deep and abiding love and allegiance for You, will help and not hurt in what we say and do. Forgive us of our blunders. Help us to be forgiving to those who blunder in our presence. Help us to place the best interpretations possible on what other people say and do. But help us most of all to strive to do what's right to Your glory and to the good of others. In Jesus' holy name we pray. Amen. Thank you very much.